I believe in miracles. Since you came along.
Good God.
You sexy things. James Dyer and Kay Ribeiro.
Hi.
What a way of introducing this podcast. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest Empire and Pilot TV podcast crossover event in association with our chums at Disney Plus. And this one is in honor of the return of the Full Monty, or as someone who lived in York at the time when the movie came out always heard it, Full Monty. That's why I heard it for years and years and years. Full Monty. Anyway, the Full Monty, the phenomenon of 1997, that was for a long, long time the biggest British film of all time at the box office, is back in limited edition form on Disney Plus. All the original cast are back: Robert Carlyle, Tom Wilkinson, Mark Addy, Leslie Sharp, Steve Hewison, Paul Barber, Hugo Spear. The gang's all here. But this time, they're keeping their clothes on. And before we get in to discuss the show and the 1997 film and all kinds of shenanigans, let's hear from some members of its cast, shall we? Because I had the great pleasure of speaking to Mark Addy, Leslie Sharp and Steve Hewison together. So Dave, Gene and Lomper. And that was yesterday in London. And then this morning, I leapt onto Zoom very, very early indeed, and spoke to Robert Carlyle, a.k.a. Gaz. And what a pleasure both of those were. First of all, you're going to hear from Mark Addy, Leslie Sharp, and Steve Hewison. Enjoy.
Mark, Leslie, Steve, welcome to the Empire podcast, / pilot podcast. It's a crossover. It's a whole thing. I'm not going to get into it. It's very complicated. Anyway, welcome back to the Full Monty.
Thank you
very much.
Is this a surprise to you? when did you first hear about it?
It was a while ago. Simon sent an email saying myself and Umberto Pasolini, who was executive producer on the movie, and Simon wrote it, obviously, we're looking at doing a State of the Nation piece, and it seemed to us a sensible way of doing it is through the eyes of characters that we met a quarter of a century ago. Are you interested? Yes. Was, you know, because it was, and you know that when Simon is in charge of writing something, it's a no-brainer. It's not going to be something that you would be picky about.
Yeah.
He knows these characters, he's lived with them all this time, and it was, and I didn't know where it was going to go, how it was going to work. It was, so yes, I'm on board. Look forward to seeing the words, and not disappointed when that happened.
Mm-hmm. And Leslie, same thing for you?
Yeah, the same, really. You know, this is a possibility. This might get made. If it did, you know, would you be interested? And it was like, yes, of course. And also, you know, Gene in the film was, I suppose, arguably, she was a satellite character because the emphasis was on the way that the demise of the steel industry had affected the self-esteem and self-confidence of that group of men.
Mm-hmm.
Gene and Dave's relationship was a very important emotional beat in that story, but she was a satellite character. So there was also, for me, the added, you know, I was really gratified that Simon had included me and the character of Gene in his plans for, you know, what he had in mind. And, you know, I wasn't disappointed when the scripts came in and I saw where he'd imagined she'd gone.
And Steve, what about yourself? Did you get that email, or was it a phone call, or a plane flown over your house? What happened?
It was a phone call. I was sat in a 16th century cellar at the time, looking at some some human bones.
was this job, hobby? What was it?
it's a long story, and they've been dead a long time.
It's all in the police report.
As long as you have an alibi, that's good.
Yeah, the phone went, and I haven't heard from Simon in years, and he said, "Would you be interested in me and Umberto are considering doing a series?" And yes, I said yes straight away.
I was just honoured, I think, to be, because he said how much I respect you as a performer, and I thought I'd been forgotten over the years, and I was just looking at these bones, thinking that's me next. And so I said, count me in.
And did he say you were going to be climbing high above Bramall
Lane?
No,
he didn't mention any of that at the time. No, he didn't give me anything other than
all his own stunts. You know,
really,
our very own Tom Cruise.
I was going to say, or Harold Lloyd, or
I was up there on that gantry. Yeah,
yeah.
Well we could have. We did have the option of shooting it in, whatever the term is, in a studio with
the green screen, green
screen, whatever. We went and had a look at that, and I said to the stunt chap, I said, wouldn't it be better in reality, if I did it? He said, well, are you up for doing that? I said, well, if it'll look better. He says, it always looks better in reality.
Yeah.
I said, come on, let's go and have a look then. Well, yeah, I can do that. I'm terrified of heights. but I trusted the crew.
I'm also terrified of heights. Watching that sequence was a white knuckler, as they say. Like, I'm uneasy being on this chair right now. I'd be a lot happier on the floor. Yeah. But you were how many feet up are you? That's.
Oh, I'm terrible. I'm terrible. Delft Cathedral. I was up a few years ago in the steeple of Delft Cathedral. You got this spiral staircase and then these little alcoves that you can stand in while other people had come in past. And I stood in one and the door opened behind me and I suddenly found myself in the gutter of Delft Cathedral, about 200 feet up. And I froze. They had to ease me out of the gutter and back in.
You were nervous how long you were on the maps.
Google Maps, cool, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, enough about me.
You're beginning... You became a landmark of local interest at some point. But I'm fascinated. I'm always fascinated by the idea of a writer and actors coming back to characters that they created 25, 26, 30 years ago, however long it is. In this case, obviously, it's 26 years now. You know, and do you as actors think about these characters once you play them the first time around? Once Full Monty comes out, and we'll talk about the significant impact it had. But once that movie came out, are they gone for you? Or do you begin to think about it? Do you still think about it from time? I wonder what Dave would be doing now. I wonder what Gene would be up to. I wonder what Lomper would be up to.
It varies. I mean, but there are certain jobs that you have a real fondness and affection for because you loved the character, but also because you had such a good time with the people that you were working with. And the Full Monty definitely falls into that category for me. Mm. But actually... you have to be, although you sort of join forces and you become almost like a family, like a creative community, when it's done, it's done.
Mm.
And actually you have to let it go because otherwise it would drive you crazy and you've got to sort of like move on to the next thing and let it go. So I can't say that over the years I wondered what Gene and Dave would be up to. But then the minute that Simon said that he was thinking about, right, you think, oh, well, I wonder where they might have gone to. I wonder what they will have done,
It is a bit difficult to escape the characters at times when people shout, oi, droopy tits, across the street.
Look, I apologise for that.
I'm assuming they're talking to me.
Or the Steve set where the one that I guess most of us most often get is, oh, I didn't recognise you with your clothes on.
Damn it, that was my next question. But I guess it does come back to the cultural impact of this film. I was a student in York at the time when the movie came out, and I just remember that film hitting like nothing else I'd ever seen. I had friends who worked in the cinema in the Odeon, and they you'd go and meet them after the cinema closed, and what's on 3 months after the movie's out in the main screen, Full Monty.
Unbelievable.
It would close, yeah. And then hundreds of people would just be disgorged down the stairs. Yeah. I mean, it's just incredible.
And the demographic, because I'm from York, and my mum used to take a carload every week, different friends, to go every week, which is like... And her, but she said, no, the amazing thing, when it first opened, It was your 18 to 39 year old, the average, you know, your average cinema goer.
What was the rating? What did you call it? No, yeah, was it PG or was
it
X? Or 15.
It was 15. 15.
Yeah. 15. Yeah.
So your average, you know, but then the following week, it was like they told mum and dad, you know, no, you should go and see it. And then it was the grandpa. The audience got older.
And then it was the men, because the men had gone, yes, no, I'm not going to see that. It's a woman.
That's all it's about. Blokes taking the clothes off.
No, I don't want to see men taking the clothes off.
To start with, there were a lot of kind of hen party type audiences that who then went and dragged their husbands along. Yeah. Like, oh, this is all right, actually. Yeah.
And how many times have you been to the cinema, watched a film, and people have applauded at the end?
Yeah. It's very rare, especially over here. You know, we're too reserved for that sort of thing. But
Yeah. I've never, apart from Land and Freedom, I think.
Yes.
That got a round of applause when I saw that. But I've never been in a cinema where people have applauded a film before.
And it had an extraordinary impact culturally, and it must have had an extraordinary impact on all three of you. In the immediate aftermath of the Full Monty, was it a cross to bear for a while? Was there worries about typecasting, or did you use it as an opportunity to push on and do new things?
It was a mixed thing. I mean, I suppose the good thing about it, as I always said at the time, was that it made the industry realise, oh, look, he can act. So, you know, I didn't have to keep proving myself all the time.
Yeah.
I still had to audition for things, but, you know, I had something to chalk up there where people could say, oh, yeah, we know you can do it. But at the same time, the casting directors, who I don't think they had a great deal of imagination as to, you know, they just saw, all right, northern working class, probably gay, lives with his mother, security guardish kind of character, well, call up Hewison. And, you know, after a while you get, you know, it's very different to the theatre where, you know, previously to that I'd been playing a genie. In a primary school production, when I got offered the job, I didn't tell them that I was touring, doing a literary play for 5-year-olds.
Wow!
But you know, you can go from playing all these vast. I've played a lump of cheese once in a play. You can do that, but then as soon as I see just one thing on screen, that's it. It's very difficult to break.
Was it the Mousetrap?
You set him up.
It was difficult to break the mold.
Oh, Edam it. Leslie, what about yourself?
Well, you know, I think probably the boys were the focus of the aftermath. But, I mean, to my delight and surprise, I was nominated as Best Supporting Actress at the BAFTAs, which was brilliant. And I think just it's just if you've been in a successful film or television show, even if you're not at the centre of it, there's still something about what that means you can bring into a room if you're being considered for another role and might give you, you know, might put you slightly ahead of the game. So I'm very grateful to the film for what it added to where I was at that point in my career. You know, it was great.
And Mark?
Changed my I was I think when it came to promoting the movie in the States, because it opened in America before the UK. Bobby was busy shooting. Tom Wilkinson was off shooting. And so they said, will you come and do the press? I hadn't done a movie before that. I'd done theatre and start making my way in TV. I'm scheduled to do one of the Ruth Rendell mysteries over there. And my agent said, well, maybe you should, we can scrub the Ruth Rendell and maybe you should go and did a whole, you know, and it was a complete eye-opener doing, literally going, you know, American TV talk, you know, idiot, wide-eyed northerner talking about his film that he's in and what have you. But the whole of because I was there as it took off and just started to, because they only opened on like six screens.
Handful, yeah, yeah.
Completely, you know, two in LA and four in New York or the other way around. But they'd put the word out really, really heavily. So people were queuing around the block to try and get in, and that that word, and then the word of mouth thing started happening. And so then, of course, when it came here, it was the little British movie that's doing big business in America.
Sundance, as well.
Which Sundance, yeah, but we were there for that. And so anyone who was anyone in Hollywood had to see it because it cost that much, and it's taken. Why isn't that the system that we're working on?
What's the formula?
On?
Give me the formula.
What's the secret?
Yeah.
But also, you know, it was interesting, the kind of loss of anonymity is very weird. So to go from, you know, people just watching you as you walk by to people going, are you that bloke from, to people going, are you Mark Addy? Is a real, relatively quickly, to go from being just some guy walking down the street to people knowing your name was a bit of a, you know, I mean, it's hard to get your head around that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are worse things to be known for, I suppose, which is, I am, you know, it was a life, career-changing movie.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk then about where Simon has found you guys, found your characters again in this. Mentioned it a little bit. We can't talk about it in great detail, but Dave and Jean's marriage, I mean, there's some darkness at the center of it now, and, you know, and it's still very solid on the surface, but not necessarily underneath.
Mm.
Was that a surprise to you both, and was it exciting to play and explore that side of their relationship?
Definitely.
Absolutely,
in the film, they were sort of the poster couple for mutual support, affirmation, and love, full of love.
Love, hope for the future, a brighter, you know what I mean, a better future.
And actually, you know, in the hands of someone else, you might have said, actually, they tick all of the boxes that you're supposed to tick. So they might have had two or three children who by now would have gone through school and gone through further education and be up and running in the world and maybe had children themselves and that they were grandparents. And so what do we make of that situation? But actually what Simon did was he said, no, they didn't have kids. What did that mean? How has that bent them out of shape as people, as individuals and as a couple? And then suddenly you've got something really interesting to explore, because what it does to Jean is make her access her ambition and her educational aspirations. So she's gone through teacher's assistant, teacher, deputy headmistress, and now she's running a school. And that's not a bed of roses either. But that's where her safe place is. You know, connecting with her internal engine. And Dave has slightly retreated. He's been her cheerleader in the way that she was for him back in the day and said, you can do anything, go for it, go for it, go for it. But what that means now is that they're sort of out of whack. And the conversations that they have needed to have, that didn't happen for us. That's still really painful. Mm. They haven't had. And actually, that means that they're in a dangerous place, because the tectonic plates of their relationship have moved and are in danger of really shifting to a point where they're not connected anymore. So it's death by a thousand paper cuts, which I think that a lot of relationships can fall into. But I didn't see that coming with Dave and Jean. So to read that Simon had invested in them in that way and given them that story to tell, I think is really bold. And you know, it's also about the pair of them kind of having to take responsibility for their part in the failure of their relationship at this point. And that's really interesting too. It's done in a very three-dimensional way.
Yeah, so completely. No, that's all right. There's a point at the end of We obviously can't talk. We've got to be careful. Mm. There's a point at the end of episode two, mm-hmm. which, when I was reading it, I had the same response that both our preview audiences had, which was a kind of visible intake
gasp.
Of breath at what.
Yeah.
What has what is happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's really rare when you. I mean, yeah. reading a script that actually shocks you.
There's so much to explore here, guys. I've got to let you go, but there's so much to explore here. There's so much depth and shade and barely repressed anger about. You were talking, Mark, right at the beginning about this being a State of the Nation piece, and the nation's in a state.
Absolutely.
The nation's in a state, yeah. but it's explored by Simon with wit, warmth, generosity and goodwill. Mm. So he pulls no punches in his writing, but he ameliorates that with great heart and love mm-hmm. for the characters and for that community.
Absolutely. Well, guys, I got to let you go. Steve, Leslie and Mark, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much indeed.
Thank you.
Steve, back to your bones. All right, so that was Mark Addy, Leslie Sharp and Steve Hewison. And now let's go straight into Robert Carlyle, shall we? Begbie himself, Gaz himself. Yes, indeed. One of our best actors. Here he is talking to me. One of our worst interviewers. What a marriage. What a match made in heaven. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on this Full Monty podcast by the star of Full Monty 1997 and 2023, Robert Carlyle. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. Is this all a bit surreal?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I suppose. You know, there was never any kind of indication that this was ever going to happen. So from that perspective, yeah. But you know, now that we're kind of now that the kind of the band is bandwagon is rolling, it seems it's good. It's very good in actual fact. It's very, very good.
Yeah.
Enjoying it.
I imagine it was an interesting experience. I spoke yesterday to Mark and Steve and Leslie. And coming back to it was a surreal experience for them, but yeah. But it felt like a good one as well. Like they really got a chance to bond again because you get more yeah. time this time with
it's
with
one
everybody.
Of these things. I mean, Phil Monty's like a massive, you know, it's like a massive big warm shadow that's kind of followed me through my whole career. So getting the opportunity to go back to that and revisit that again, you know, it's a kind of comforting thing in a way.
When did that come up for you? Because Mark said he got an email from Simon. Steve says he got a phone call. What was it for you?
It was carrier pigeon for me. No, it was emails. I know Simon and I had sort of been in touch through the years as well, and email came in a couple of years ago. Prior to that, he'd been asked to kind of, you know, do a sequel or come up with a sequel to Full Monty as a movie, and it was never something that he was interested in. I wouldn't have been interested in that either, to be honest. Mm. But as I say, a couple of years ago when he got in touch, he said, well, how about doing this now, 25 years later, as an 8-part TV series investigating these people's lives and how they are and how they've been. And I thought, this sounds like an extremely good idea.
And there's no nudity. That's one of the things to establish rightfully off.
Mate, nobody wants to see that, believe me.
That's one of the things I thought was, I mean, I thought the series was great. And one of the things I thought was fascinating about it is that it's a Full Monty in name only. Not to give too many spoilers yeah. away for people who haven't got to it yet.
It is in name only, but of course, that is the kind of, you know, the hook that you have to hang the whole thing on. That's what gets people interested. That's what gets people watching. But it's got nothing to do with that. You know, I mean, the phrase, the Full Monty, you know, I mean, going the whole way kind of thing. Mm. It doesn't really have any relevance to the TV show, really. Yeah. So it's really just the name of the film is the only thing that's remains from that time.
Yeah, there's obviously it's talked about, it's mentioned, it's referenced, you know, talked about how it changed the lives of all the characters. And there's again, without giving anything away, there's a very funny reference to it in an episode in which, yeah. shall we say, an unlikely hostage situation develops.
Yes, unlikely hostage. And it's very funny. That is very funny. And it's meant to be kind of stupid and kind of pathetic. But there was never any talk or discussion about should we take our clothes off again. Just never.
No matter how much you insisted. Wasn't going
to
happen.
Just didn't listen to me.
Put it back on, Robert. Put it back on. But it's interesting as well because of that, this is a real deep dive into these characters, into Gaz and Dave and Gene and Lomper and all the gang. Horses arc in this is really bittersweet and sad and devastating. Yeah. And Mark Yerste was saying whenever Simon first got in touch with him that, Simon said, it's time to do a State of the Nation piece. And this feels like it is a piece that is driven by barely repressed anger about the way that everything seems to be going to the dogs.
Yeah. Well, 25 years hasn't been kind, for these people, hasn't been kind for a lot of people. 25 years of austerity. Mm. And that's chipped away at people's lives, and it's chipped away at these characters, that's for sure. Chipped away at the very infrastructure of the country. The mess that we've got with the NHS and, the way things are going, even these rail strikes, nurses strikes. It's right. I mean, it's a state. I think that's right to say it's a State of the Nation piece, because back then in '97, when the film came out, Blair had just came in. Remember the "things can only get better" moment with Neil Kinnock, if you remember that kind of embarrassing moment. Well, things didn't get better. Things, in actual fact, have got worse. And I think that these characters' lives in this show kind of reflect that, and I think they reflect a lot of people's experience in the last 25 years.
Yeah, it's multifaceted. There's all sorts of stuff going on. Gaz is in an interesting place. He's still got that sort of roguish element to him. He ends the first episode in an unlikely situation again. What sort of conversations did you have with Simon about how he evolved as a character over the last 25 years? Or was it all Simon, or did you bring ideas to the table yourself?
It's 98% Simon. He's such a brilliant writer. You don't mess with it. He's come up with all of this. There's a couple of little things that I kind of added in here and there, a few lines here and there. The thing that I did want to add in was the kind of vanity, the kind of moment when he's got his face mask on and the nose hair clippers and stuff like this and filing the nails. I thought because I'm sure that's Gaz, he's going to try and hang on. He's not going to go gracefully into old age. He's going to be dragged kicking and screaming. And that's that. he certainly is getting dragged kicking and screaming. So, but mostly and mainly, as I say, 99% stuff. It's all the brilliance of Simon before.
What's interesting as well is that his life is, he's still got a twinkle in the eye to an extent, but there's still a sense that things didn't quite go for him the way that if you were writing fan fiction, for example, you would say that what happened at the end of the Full Monty, all the guys would be propelled into this glorious happy ending that would last for 25 years, and we'd pick up with him 25 years later, and he wouldn't be living in a caravan, and he wouldn't have messed his life up in terms of his relations with his family. I thought it was really, really interesting that there's a darkness here, an inherent darkness.
Well, it's and thank you. And that's what I would have expected from Simon. I think all of these characters and guys, speaking of guys, he's exactly where you kind of want him to be in a sense as a viewer. There's nothing Hollywood about this. No one's went off and done anything stupid. They are where they are. These are victims of the last 25 years. He is still, he's still as excitable as he always was, exuberant, and the man with a plan, even though his plans generally blow up in his face most of the time. There's a lot of love about the character. He's big-hearted.
Yeah.
Huge, big-hearted, and a great sense of justice, Gas. What's right and what's wrong. And I think the interesting thing about that, of course, is that kind of goes through the family. That's the one thing they kind of share. Because Destiny, the wonderfully named Destiny, his daughter. Of course, Gaz's daughter's going to call Destiny. She has a sense of what's right and what's wrong. And you see that runs really strong through the arc of that character. And of course, his son is a policeman. There's another sense of right and wrong.
And what about returning to this role after so many years away? I mean, you had this experience recently with Begbie in Trainspotting 2, of course. Yeah. Is it like putting on an old coat, or do you have to take a while to get back into the rhythms of a character, the mannerisms of a character, the voice of a character even?
Yeah. The voice mainly, because of course I don't sound like that. And also, you're trying to get this kind of a Yorkshire accent, but also a Yorkshire accent that you used 25 years ago. So it's a kind of a double kind of aim for me to get it right. Not, you know, it's, you know, nothing's easy. I mean, nothing in this business is easy. It's always difficult. There's always kind of problems and things that you have to kind of overcome in order to achieve anything. But if anything did make it easier, it was the fact that I was in with all these guys that I love from 25 years, and this kind of thing that we all have, this bond that we share through this film, which has been, you know, massive in our lives. So it was warmth, you know, and just nice to be able to kind of look across the room in a scene and see those faces that have kind of followed me my whole life. And it does, I mean, it's a corny thing to say maybe, but it did genuinely feel like family. It felt like a kind of family thing that we were back together again. So that when you've got that knowledge of each other, then there's a kind of shorthand with the working, with the scenes. You can get to where you want to go an awful lot quicker without any discussion, massive discussion about this stuff. So overall, you know, as I say, I'm kind of contradicting myself that, you know, things, nothing's ever easy. But knowing the rest of the cast as well as I do, smooth the path.
Mm. So I guess the first few days, were you keen to get a group day in your first few days to help ease you back in, or was it very much Gaz and Destiny, or Gaz on his own?
It was actually, if I remember rightly, the first few days was just myself and Mark doing a couple of scenes, and it took a while. I think it was maybe this actually even the third week of filming before we actually did the cafe scene. And it was really only when we started to shoot the cafe stuff that I really felt it was all back together again, you know, because all the faces are in about you everywhere. Prior to that, as I said, myself and Mark, and also myself and Talitha, Destiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, fantastic.
She's really great. And I want to talk as well, Robert, about the impact of the original and the way that hit and became this cultural phenomenon. I have this memory etched in my brain, and no one else seems to remember this, of Simon doing an American Express advert. Do you remember that at all?
Simon did an American Express advert?
Simon did an American Express advert. It was full Monty screenwriter, Simon Beaufoy, lounging by a pool, talking about... Yeah, honestly, either I dreamt this or...
You dream? I'm thinking
I don't know. I'm not sure. It was just after the film came out, and it was like, it was all the rage. And I just remember this. And for me, if that's real, if that exists, and I haven't just dreamt it, that kind of...
I think that's in another dimension. Surely that didn't happen.
After this interview, ask Simon if he ever did.
Hello?
Either an American Express advert or certainly a TV commercial where it was him by a pool. And the idea was that Full Monty had made him this incredible success, and now look at life and what it's like. Ask him about it. He may deny everything, but that will only just
deny it, yeah.
Yeah, that will only just add to my
googling it myself.
But my point is that movie changed everything for everybody.
Yes, absolutely.
Including you, because obviously you'd had Trainspotting the year before, and you know, your life had already changed by that point. But even so, the success of that movie, was it unparalleled in a way, even compared to what Trainspotting had done?
Absolutely. I mean, leading up to, you know, there's always kind of like steps on the way, you know what I mean? You can trace back, and I'd done a few things in Britain that had sort of led me to that point, particularly... did a thing called Cracker, you know, people might remember, you know, years and years ago. That took me on to Trainspotting, Trainspotting took me on to Full Monty. So there was a kind of a gradual kind of progression, but Full Monty just blew open North America. That was the main difference, and it opened up doors for me there and opportunities. So it's not exaggerating at all to say that it was life changing.
And what was it like for you being in the middle of that? I was speaking yesterday again to Mark and Leslie and Steve, and I was recalling my memories of that film coming out, because I lived in York at the time and I had friends who worked in the Odeon Cinema, and just going to meet them after work 3-4 months after the film came out, and it was still playing in the main screen, and it would finish at 10:30 and the doors would open and literally hundreds of people would come down the stairs 3-4 months in. And I hadn't really seen anything like that before, especially for a British film. And that's just me as a film student at the time watching that sort of stuff. What was it like for you being in the middle of it?
It's not exaggerating to say that it truly was a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon was taking place. The first time I've ever, and only time I've ever actually went to see a film of mine in the cinema, because it came out, it was out about a month or two, and it's just this avalanche kind of thing was happening. I thought, we're going to see this. I could just witness this thing that people are talking about. And I went to see it in Glasgow. Baseball cap on up the back. And the reactions were just incredible. People, you know, laughing, cheering, standing up. You know, it was this incredible thing. It really, really touched people. Did something. I mean, if I knew why, be a rich man, because I'd be writing movies like that myself.
If you knew why, you would have done Full Monty. You'd be on Full Monty 27 by now.
That would be interesting.
Well, that experience of watching that film at the time must have been really interesting. Did you leave before the very, very end? Because, you know, Robert, it has one of the most famous freeze frame endings in history, and it is your backside amongst others that is part of that freeze frame.
Yes. No, I did. I stayed to the end. I mean, as soon as that happened, I was out. But I did. I watched the whole thing. And of course, that the remarkable thing about that as well was that when the hats go and you see sort of behind, you know, the all those characters in the forefront behind, you see this. Sort of rise. There's a kind of, and that's what happened, because the whole thing was like an explosion went off in that room when the hats went. And the same thing happened in the cinema. Same thing happened. People jumped up, people cheered and stuff like that. I was like, oh my God, this is, I don't know, life imitating art.
That is wild. That's wild. This may be deeply intrusive, but I have to ask, did you guys go the Full Monty, or did you go Red Hot Chili Peppers with some enhancements?
Nothing like that. It was utterly, utterly birthday suit material.
Just make sure no one has cameras. Yeah, thank God it was 1997, right? So no one had camera phones.
You know, interestingly enough, that was an issue, because there was some early camera phones back then.
Right.
Nokia had one. And it was me that said to production, I said, look, make sure you're searching people coming in and take their phones. And there was a big kind of like kerfuffle about that, because they didn't know what to do. I said, well, I'm not doing this unless you get all these phones away. Thank God. Because even just one rogue picture could have really been extremely embarrassing, to put it mildly. And of course, these days, like photographs and stuff, they're there forever, aren't they? Suddenly on the net. You circulate, that's it. So thank God there was no camera phones in the room.
Yeah, it would be on TikTok before the day was out. That'd be horrendous. But I've got to go in a second, but I just wanted to ask one last thing about we're talking about the political content of the TV show, and the kind of the secret ingredient of the original film. And yeah, it's feel good, and yes, it leaves you on a high and you bounce out of the cinema. But I think people forget how political the first movie is, and how Gaz and the guys are motivated by the steel mills shut in, and you know, their lives basically disintegrating in front of them. I think in a way that's a secret ingredient. You know, it tapped into what people were feeling at the time.
You know, you can't separate the politics, Phil Monty. You cannot separate it. It's the politics is the reason why they did the strip in the first place. You know, and similarly, the politics is what actually drives this show. It's not. I mean, it's great that people remember it funny. You know what I mean? And that's because it was funny. This show, TV show, is also funny. But it's got more than that. It's got more than that. It's not just about, you know, certainly the TV show, we're not just trying to recreate what happened in 1997, you know what I mean? There's just no way. That would be just insane to try and do that. But this is a piece. I think about them as companion pieces now, really, in a sense.
Yeah.
And these are pieces with a heart, you know, and the hearts and the mind of Simon Beaufoy and everybody involved. They're good and honourable people, and we've tried to make a good and honourable show.
Absolutely, and you know, it ends in this. I'm not going to give away the ending, but it's a bittersweet ending, I would say, rather than the sort of triumphant ending of the film.
I think it's beautiful. It's beautiful. You know, I remember shooting and loved reading that particular episode, and it'll definitely affect people, no doubt.
Absolutely. Is this it, or do you think you guys might come back? Not another 25 years, but is
well, you never say never. You know. I mean, who'd have thought we were coming back 25 years later? So who knows? I love the character. I love the world, the terrain. It's where I come from. I mean, these are my type of people, and I love telling stories that giving voice to people who don't have a voice.
Robert Carlyle, it's been an absolute pleasure. But I'm going to let you go. Thanks so much for your time.
Nice to talk to you. All the best.
All right, so that was Robert Carlyle, and now let's talk about the Full Monty. Full Monty. Let's talk about Full Monty, shall we? Shall we start at the beginning? 1997. Kay, I don't imagine you were alive then.
No, barely.
Barely alive.
A twinkle in my dad's eye.
But yes, you were a young whippersnapper. Jimbo, you and I are old relics.
Yeah.
What are your memories of the Full Monty?
I believe I went to see it after reading the Empire review.
Well, look at that. So on brand.
Yeah, so on brand.
Always on brand. And then I went and saw it in the cinema. Because it was, I mean, it was buzzy, wasn't it? People were talking about it, even, you know, even after the first week. I think it opened pretty strong, didn't it? So
it did, yeah.
So
apparently it opened in the States first and then became a bit of a phenom over there. And then it actually weirdly opened here after that.
That is strange.
Yeah, that is very, very strange.
I wonder
That's what Mark Addy says.
Which is an interesting thing because it's a very British film in the way that this is a very British series, in that there's a lot in here, I think, regardless of where you're coming at it from. But I think certainly the political side of it hits differently if you're from the UK, because both the first film, which begins with that brilliant 70s informational video, Sheffield is glorious, come and see our wonderful steelworks, look, there are people shopping in the shops and swimming in swimming pools, Sheffield is really going places. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And then it segues straight into the, you know, it's been empty for 10 years, the steel mill is all kind of knackered. No, not empty, but they've worked there for 10 years.
They have worked
and
there
the steel
for 10 years,
mill
yes.
is abandoned, it is. And it's all about essentially the working
Sheffield
class
steel.
And the decline of manufacturing in the Midlands.
Yes.
Isn't it? So, and that's, you know, that's something I'd imagine Americans might have been a little bit lost in at the time.
Yeah, but I think that's a universal thing.
Well,
yeah,
especially if you look at the Rust Belt in the US, you look at Detroit, look at Motor City.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, it's a very similar phenomenon, isn't it?
So. Very much so. Mm. Very much so. And I think there was a universality to that. And also, it's wonderful, glorious, feel-good ending of a movie. But it is. It's Ken Loachian. It's Mike Lee. And strange word to say, but Lee-esque. That's a much better way of saying it. In the fact that it is, the first movie is Trojan Horse in all these themes and all this kind of rancor about the system and the state of the world. And that is much less Trojan horsed, I would say, in the Full Monty, the TV show.
But also, I mean, obviously it was about all those things, but the camaraderie and the feel-good factor was so high. And as you say, that is a universal theme. And it really comes across in this new series as well, about them all pulling together.
Can I make a confession? As well, I wasn't a big fan of the film when it first came out.
Ooh, that is a big confession. Why not?
Because I was studying film at the time in York, and I've talked in both the interviews about how ubiquitous it was and how you couldn't go anywhere in your email, which obviously was just fairly close to Sheffield. You know, all part of Yorkshire, isn't it? York is part of Yorkshire. Hot scoop there, Chris. And my friends and I, we reacted against its success. After a while, we just became a little bit fed up with it. And it took me a long time to kind of get past that. You know, it's a very British thing, isn't it? That idea of something that's a huge success. I mean, it's hard now to really think about how big this was. Those the anecdote I told in the Robert Carlyle and Mark Addy, Leslie Sharp, Steve Hewis in interviews was absolutely true. 3 months in, 4 months into this thing's run, and you would go to meet your mates at Odeon, York Odeon. They'd be getting off work at 10:30. The last movie of the night would be playing, and it was still the full Monty, and it was still in screen one, and it would still disgorge literally hundreds of people coming down the stairs. And what was interesting, as Mark Addy alluded to, was watching the demographics change over time as it got slightly older, and then more blokes started going to see it. That was fascinating. But yeah, I had a bit of what? Stop, shut up about the full Monty, will you?
It's not PTSD. You've been exposed to it too much.
A little bit. So weirdly enough, when the news came that they were making it again, I was like, really? Is there a story there to tell? And I revisited the film. I hadn't seen it in a long time, about 25 years. I revisited the film last year. And I honestly was very much taken aback by how much I liked it this time around.
But it's not what you think. Like, in your memory, it's a comedy about strippers. And it is neither a comedy, nor is it about strippers.
Precisely.
And that's what's quite interesting about it. It's about male bonding. It's a drama. It's part political commentary. It's like, as you say, it's the kind of thing you can imagine Mike Lee, Ken Loach would have gone in there in their donkey jackets and given a curt nod and walked out at the end. They'd have been pleased. They'd have given it a tacit seal of approval, I think.
a tacit seal of approval.
Yes. Yeah.
Ken would have buffed the corduroy patches on his jacket.
He would. But he'd approve. What I liked about this series, because I wasn't sure where this series was going to go, because you're thinking, like, this is not going to be about stripping. I was reasonably certain from the get-go, unless they were teaching a new generation of male strippers. Thankfully, that is not the case. But what it does is it dials into what the film, which was really about, which is about the abandonment of the working class. And if you think of the first one, so 97, was that pre or post Blair coming in? I can't remember.
Was Blair Witch or Tony Blair?
Blair Witch, yeah. I mean, we're interchangeable. But do you know what I mean? Like, when was it? When did New Labour get in?
New Labour got in, well, it would have been May 1997.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, whereas, and this is very much a reflection of, like, you know, years and years of austerity, right? So it hits a lot harder, and it's very much, it's a commentary on levelling up, it's a commentary on the abandonment of the North, the abandonment of the working classes, and how there's no help for people who need help. And they don't pull their punches on this. Like, it's funny in places, it's really, you know,
I think it's
heartwarming.
Very funny in places. Yeah.
But it has a very serious point to make, and it doesn't mess about. Like, it makes that point quite starkly and brutally. And I think it's difficult to watch this without feeling slightly ashamed of, you know, the fact that we are part of a society that basically leaves people to their own devices and abandons them.
We should say that we've seen all 8 episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're only going to discuss. I mean, I touch upon certain things that happened in the interviews, but we're gonna avoid spoilers. So fear not about that. But I think it's fair to say that this is a huge part of it. Like, Dave and Jean, who I think are in many ways are the emotional heart of the show, are, you know, they work at this school. Jean is the headmistress, and Dave is the janitor. And so immediately you got that disparity in standing and status there right away, which is very, very interesting. You got a trauma that happened, which we learn about in the show, as you heard in the interview. And there's something else going on under the surface of their marriage as well. But because they both work at the same school, it's very much about how funding has been cut. There is no funding. I have friends who work in schools. I have friends who are teachers. And this is very much the reality that there is no funding, that a roof will cave in from time to time. And it is up to the teachers and the staff to kind of, you know, of their own devices, try and raise funds to fix this stuff. And there's a feeling of a stark feeling of helplessness and barely repressed anger is a phrase I've used a couple of times already, but that runs through this. As Simon Beaufoy and Alice Nutter, who basically is his co-writer in this, you know, clearly feel very, very passionately about what is happening in this country right now.
Yeah, and the bureaucratic callousness, the fact that there is no sympathy, or indeed humans half the time you can get hold of, and when you do, nobody seems to be interested. And this deals with, you know, it deals with the education sector, it deals with the NHS, it deals with the whole universal credit debacle, you know, small businesses. It's got quite a broad remit.
I really feel that most pertinently with the character of Horse,
mm-hmm.
and played by Paul Barber, and you know how he's treated throughout, and you know, I won't spoil anything, but he really goes through it, and you see how, you know, it's so easy for people to be forgotten about, and you know, left to really just quite chronic and awful situations, and how that affects them and their mental health, their physical health. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really retained its DNA, which is social commentary on everything that they've experienced up there and like, and been abandoned. And I think I really love how actually the opening scenes, like a montage showing how, you know, a nod to the past, how they all got together, but also a summary of like the time that's elapsed, which is basically 7 prime ministers, 8 northern regeneration policies later, and nothing really has, you know, improved. They're still in a really dire situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great transition in the opening montage that goes from them walking towards the Working Men's Club where they do the big show at the end of the Full Monty, and then it fades into what it's like today, which is basically it's closed, it's dilapidated, it's run down, and it's like, oh, right there, that's the show in microcosm right there. But, you know, it does have its humorous moments. Obviously, it does have its heartfelt moments as well. There's some really interesting stuff going on with Gaz in particular, who is still a kind of Jack the Lad. He's still a bit of a rogue. He still makes terrible, terrible decisions. And I thought it was interesting, as I said in the interview with Robert Carlyle, which I know you guys have listened to, there's an obvious way that Simon Beaufoy could have gone with, you know, when he was making a sequel, essentially. The obvious way is we're coming back for one more show. Something's happening. One of us is in dire straits, needs money to pay for a big medical bill or something like that. And so we'll do it one more time. And he avoids that very, very neatly. Or another way to go would have been to show that this thing, this event kind of had a great effect on everybody and bounced him into this glorious, prosperous future. And that's not what happens at all.
Well, they go down to London and they start a full-time stripping career.
Yes.
I would love that.
That would be great. And they start Magic Mike.
Yes, they are the OGs. Absolutely. Coining it in the West End.
Magic Mike XS. I'm guessing. But they don't do that. Like when we start off, like Dave and Gene seem to be happy on the surface, but there might be something else going on there. Horse is in a bad way. And Gaz is basically just, you know, he's living in a caravan. He's kind of messed up his various relationships and he's still, you know, living on the fly and living on the sly.
And trying to get mattresses onto buses.
Yes.
God loves a trier. He, in every aspect of his life, he is
certainly trying.
Yeah.
Could you get a mattress onto a bus?
I mean, he did. I mean, that is a spoiler, but he did get the mattress on the bus.
He had to pay full fare, though. Yeah.
No, he had to pay a half fare. He got away with it.
He managed, he's a raconteur.
Impressive work.
He managed to persuade the driver that the mattress must be under 16, so therefore pay a junior fare. It's not bad. I don't think I could do that. I don't have the gift of the gab.
They wouldn't let you on. They wouldn't let you through.
They wouldn't let me on.
The doors wouldn't even open. Mm. Yeah.
You're not bringing that old threadbare thing on here. Yeah.
Talking to the mattress.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, James. I set him up. You very much lock him down. But looking at the show, so they don't do the obvious thing. Simon Beaufoy doesn't do the obvious thing. So were you guys impressed by that? I have to say I was impressed by that. I was very, very glad that it wasn't the let's do one more show thing.
I was very relieved because, as we know, there's so many remakes now. A lot of them unnecessary, in my opinion. But to find out like this was sort of like a continuation, what happens next, and also like, you know, they've breathed new life in it by having new characters to follow. So the younger generation that we get to see, which I think they've been well cast.
Yeah, really well cast.
And actually, like, so there's Destiny, played by Talitha Wing, who's fantastic as Gaz's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And also Twiglet, a character called Twiglet, which actually was my nickname at school.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Genuinely?
Probably won't go into it now, but yeah. Tell you off pod. He's also known as Dean, and he's played by Aidan Cook. And he strikes up a really sweet and quite amusing relationship with Mark Addy's character,
Dave.
Dave, yeah. And that's really joyful to see. And again, it's all, you know, they, I think what he, the writer does so well, Simon, is that he just, he kind of raises these, he's still raising important issues, but, you know, in a completely, you know, realistic and authentic way. It's not heavy handed. And with these two younger characters, particularly, we kind of see from their point of view how growing up in poverty is for them and the different things they have to navigate and how tough it is for them. And how, like, people like Gaz is just trying to do the best he can, but yeah, it's always falling short.
No, just but going back to what you said about how it kind of surprised you, I think it's the difference between Disney saying, hey, look, we've got an IP we can rinse, and drafting in like a jobbing screenwriter to do another run at the Full Monty or a remake of the Full Monty, or having the original screenwriter who clearly still has a story to tell, picking up the pieces and actually creating something that means something to them.
Yeah. Does anyone else, just before we get into that a little bit more, the Robert Carlyle interview, I talked about this American Express commercial that Simon Beaufoy did. Do either of you remember this?
Nope.
No. Can you act it out now?
So basically it was something like, it was on TV, it was maybe a year after Full Monty, maybe 6 months after Full Monty, and it was Simon Beaufoy by a pool in Hollywood, and the basic idea was, and you know, that song, You Sexy Thing, was playing on the soundtrack, and he was basically loving life, and everyone was going, here's the Full Monty screenwriter Simon Beaufoy, and look what he's doing because he's got his American Express card. And I swear to you, I didn't dream this.
It seems like an odd thing to do. He's not the most recognizable person.
I know, right? That's the interesting thing about it.
I'm going to say part of your, you know, you talked about your trauma of having had to see it so much when you were growing up. I think your brain has done something where it's created something that was not true.
Yeah.
You ever think you've dreamt it, or your brain has tried to protect you from other things and has now made up this commercial because I don't think it exists. And
no.
Have you, more importantly, have you been able to find anything on the interweb about it?
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, exactly. That silence tells you everything. He's made it up. Wow. I haven't
made it up.
Evidence to the contrary.
I haven't made it up. Whilst I Google Simon Beaufoy commercial, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about, let's continue Kay's thought about the new generation, shall we? Because Destiny is so much fun in this show. What a great character.
Yeah, it is a nice character, but also it brings you something else. I think from a purely interest level, it gives something for younger viewers to sort of maybe latch onto, characters they can identify with slightly more, which I think is a good thing to do. But it gives you a broader spectrum. I think it's like, it's showing that these issues are not just affecting the core characters, not just affecting older people, it's affecting the young people as well. And like, you know, she's someone who's almost like a forgotten student, right? Like, she's clearly very smart, clearly very bright, clearly very talented, but because she comes from an impoverished background, is not getting support. No one really cares. No one really listens. She's been essentially written off at her school. And, you know, there is a point where this is directly addressed. Like, if she looked different, if she sounded different, if she came from a different background, she would be at a good college. She would be able to go to a good school. All these things would be very different for her. Terry White would have an awful lot to say on this particular subject. I can't help but feel.
But also, you know, that she is being, both of them are being directly affected by the hits and the cuts to the education system, right? Mm. So they are literally, I mean, Destiny's character particularly is very into music, and her, you know, with the school in disrepair, you know, often the music room isn't even available for them to use, and like, you know, no one seemingly,
no money to fix it,
cares in terms of the council, etc. But
And it's also, it deals with that idea that, you know, other cuts to youth services and whatnot, when kids don't have anything to do or anywhere to be, they end up stealing dogs. You know, who among us has not, in fact?
We've all been there.
We've all nicked a prize poodle or two in our time, haven't we?
But yeah, no, totally. Also, I like that little nod to good cultural reference. With that particular storyline. I really like the particularly Twiglet and his relationship with Dave, because I thought it was so sweet, and also because it investigates further Dave's background and things that have happened to him and with his wife, Jean. And I don't know, I was really emotionally invested in that and where Dean would end up, but. Yeah, I think the new gen are a welcome addition.
It's not just a new gen, though. I mean, as Leslie Sharp was saying, you know, she's an amazing actress. She wasn't saying that, but I'm saying that. Leslie Sharp is an amazing actress. And, you know, she's not the focus of the Full Monty film. And one of the obvious bonuses of doing this as a limited edition show means that you have effectively 8 hours to play with. And you can give an actress of her caliber more to do. So she does become one of the key emotional driving points of the show. And she's great. She's fantastic.
Yes, I know, I agree. I thought the relationship between those two, because it's tinged with tragedy, and it's a continuation of what we saw in the first one, isn't it? Where it's all about Dave's body image. Like, he has body image issues, he has confidence problems, and part of his storyline in that film is him overcoming those issues and kind of embracing who he is. And I like that in this, not only is he trying to kind of impart that message onto Twiglet, which is lovely, but also the fact that he's wrestling with personal tragedy and still trying to communicate with his partner, which he wasn't doing in the first film, and is still, obviously, that's still a point of point of contention between them.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a big, I mean, these are just big issues that are like constantly, you know, they, as you said in the first film, like communication was a massive thing that he was failing to do, and this time round again, it's like they all seem to like cyclical, going through the same sort of issues, but are still obviously so relatable to the audience.
Very much so. Very much so. And there's other characters as well who are, outside the OG, although he is an OG, which is Wim Snape, who plays Gaz's son Nathan from the first film.
Yes.
So, yeah. As a Snape, I presume he spent the last 25 years terrorizing Harry Potter, but but now he's back.
Too easy. He's back. And also his character, I mean, the where we find him is just so ironic given his roots. And I think that's a nice touch as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, it's called Sleeping with the Enemy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. is one way of putting that. But there is something to be said about just the lovely nostalgia factor of this as well. You know, it's hard hitting, but it does have these lovely detours into comedy. There's a funny bit with Lumper, as I alluded to, where he goes to Sheffield United's Bramall Lane Stadium and does a bit of business that is very Harold Lloyd-esque, which is wild. There's a future episode where they end up inadvertently being held hostage, a few of them, but again, that is like Dog Day Afternoon, right? So it's a guy with a legitimate grievance to air who makes a point, makes a stand, and our characters, our heroes get caught up in that. And that, of course, is the closest any of them come to recreating the original movie, which I thought was nice.
I would say in a tribute that works very well in this context.
Precisely.
Yeah, it's nice.
Precisely. But there's a lot of stuff going on there, and I really, really did get a kick out of watching that original cast come back. Tom Wilkinson's not in it a huge amount, but it's always nice to see Tom Wilkinson. Mm. You get a sense, or I did anyway in the interviews, you get a sense that all of them have a slightly different relationship with the film and the phenomenon that it became. And some of them really used it as a springboard and a stepping stone to bigger things. And others maybe found it a bit of a millstone around their neck. And I imagine there was a little bit of reconciliation that had to happen before some of the cast members committed to come back to this. I'm glad they did, because, you know, they get a chance to really explore different avenues of their characters.
And I don't think it would have been the same if, like, the majority of them hadn't wanted to do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it needed to be all of them, or as near to all of them as possible.
Yeah. There are not that many scenes, really, where you get to see them all together. But there is a new character he's introduced we haven't really talked about, which is Miles Jupp as Darren.
Mm.
And he's very, very good in it.
He is good, actually. Yeah. And I think he provides a slightly different flavor of character. I really liked him. I also like the fact that, because obviously all the characters they get their own little storylines. You'll get certain character focused episodes as it goes through. I really enjoyed his character focused episode, which deals with a kind of an immigration related issue, which is nice. But yeah, he's quite charming, fun. He's, you know, you get the sense he's kind of a decent guy in a slightly awkward situation given the nature of his job. But yeah, and his interactions with Leslie Sharp in particular were, I thought, a lot of fun.
Yes. Yeah.
Also, Tara Lynn O'Neill, aka the mum from Derry Girls.
Yes.
She
right.
had a great role in this as well. I love her cropping up.
She's very good.
Yeah.
Good cast. Deep bench.
Really great cast.
Deep bench. Have you guys ever been to Sheffield?
No. Should we go?
Did we
do a podcast in Sheffield?
I don't think we did.
No,
I do you know what? I genuinely don't know.
I'm up for it.
Steel
Let's
City.
Do it. Let's do it now. We should be doing this podcast from Sheffield.
Let's
live.
Do it. We should have done it from the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield.
Yeah, we should.
Yeah, I've been to Sheffield twice. Once I visited the set of Paddy Considine's Journeyman, his second movie as director. And I had to go. I had to pay a little pilgrimage to the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield, which is where the World Snooker Championship takes place every year. And I've got tickets for next year. I'm finally going. I'm ticking another one off my great sporting defence bucket list. I cannot wait.
I was going to try and bond with you some name, but Stephen Hendry's so out of the game now. I can't even.
No, Stephen Hendry's still. He's an integral.
My sister was a big fan of snooker. I used to watch a lot of snooker, and I remember a lot of it. You know, in the Crucible.
Stephen I have Hendry. No clue what either Steve of you are talking about.
Can you name a single snooker player, James?
The Whirlwind. was it Jimmy Davis? Was that his name?
Jimmy Davis.
I don't know.
Hurricane.
Someone the Whirlwind.
The Whirlwind, yes. Yeah. Whirlwind Jimmy White.
Was he the one? Oh, that's a Jimmy White.
Jimmy,
that was it.
Jimmy Whirlwind White. Yeah.
With the upside Higgins down glasses. Well.
Alex Hurricane Higgins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan.
No.
Oh, yeah. Love Ronnie.
That's gone off piste. I just love mentioning sports to James and watching the light die in his eyes.
Well, it's one of these things. I'm familiar with the concept of sport, just not the details.
I think you'd like snooker.
I really wouldn't. I even like to play. I get bored playing snooker.
So you've played snooker, so now you admit that you've played snooker.
I have played snooker. I have played badly, obviously.
Right.
As you will remember when we had an office pool table, my ability to...
That's right.
My strategy for all of these things is to line up the balls, pick one, doesn't really matter which one, hit it as hard as humanly possible, and then try and use the force to will it into one of the pockets. You know, I can't be dealing with angles and pressure and spin and any of this. It's just slam the ball and hope that they all pop themselves.
Life whereas I mean, some people have called me the most talented player of my generation. I mean, admittedly, I'm the one who says that, but still, touched by genius. Back to the full Monty, okay?
I'm no spoilers, but I've just...
No spoilers.
Just got to tell you that. I mean, obviously it's very funny and all, you know, great cast, etc. But it does, as we've said, pack a huge emotional punch. And I just have to get a warning to listeners that by the end, I was a human puddle. It's really emotional. Like, it really pulls on the heartstrings. And it's brilliant. Like, I just found it so well drawn and well played at the end that, you'll think about it for a very long time.
But also the stark contrast, right? Because it has been quite a long time.
Mm.
Like a lot of these, like this, the nature of the sort of streaming era is we've had a lot of, you know, casts coming together to revisit old roles, but rarely after this amount of time has passed. So I think the contrast is quite noted here.
Did you shed a little tear?
A little bit. Yeah. Like, it made me quite sad. The final episode in particular, I thought was really lovely.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful ending.
Get those tissues ready.
Yeah. Because the first film, again, as I said, Robert Carlyle, but the first film has, you know, one of the great freeze frame endings.
Mm.
Genuinely, it's a lot cheeky. In fact, there's about 12 of them. But it's such a fun way to go out. And I think that sort of kind of triumphant punch the air ending.
Not least of all because it literally was a full Monty moment. So.
It was, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
They delivered it for real, one take.
Yes.
I didn't realise that. Yeah.
Well, I don't think they told anyone at the time, is my understanding.
No, the reaction was genuine, yeah.
Yeah, so you can't actually see an awful lot of the reaction because it's very much focused on the buns of steel in the foreground. but they did whip the hats off and chuck them in the air.
I would love to know if they did any, like, you know, bit of extra workouts beforehand, if, you know, the actors were...
Well, they were being plied with alcohol, by all accounts, during the day.
Yeah. No, but in terms of the buns of steel.
The buns of steel. Mm. You think they did some sort of Bonnie Langford
perhaps
beforehand?
Perhaps you press up. No, what would that be? What would you do?
Who knows?
Squats.
Squats? You think squats?
Let's just leave it there, shall we? Let's leave it to the imagination, shall we?
Whatever Chris's regime is.
There's 250 to 300 people in Sheffield who've seen the full Monty, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
The tales they could tell.
Indeed.
This show does not end with the full Monty, but it does end with the full Monty emotionally. And would you be up for more of this?
100%. I really, really enjoyed this. Mm. I thought it was really good. And it did the, you know, it honoured the original, but also moved it on, and I just thought it was great, yeah. So I definitely, season two, please.
Season two. Aye, full Monty. Jimbo?
I think it has a near perfect ending. So it's one of those things where I'd almost be happier if it stood as it is, because I think it's like a perfectly contained coda to the larger story. I almost don't think you want to build on that.
Mm.
But we'll see.
We shall see. We shall see indeed. And I'm going to continue scouring the internet for this Simon Beaufoy commercial, which
doesn't exist.
Telling you
that only exists in your mind.
Okay. Simon Beaufoy, if you're listening to this, and I know that you are, please come forward and confirm that you starred as yourself in a TV commercial for a credit card. It may not be American Express, might have been Barclay Card, might have been MasterCard, might
Access,
have been Visa.
Back in the day.
Might have been Access. Oh, I'll Google that because nothing's coming up. Nothing's coming up. But I swear to you, I swear to you it happened. It was soundtracked by You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate. And I, I'm going mad.
Okay, so if you're right, we will get you something. We'll you get something small, a chocolate bar. Right?
No. Here's what.
A Twiglet.
Yeah, we'll get you a packet of Twiglets. And if you're wrong,
I don't like Twiglets.
You've got to do the full Monty throughout past all these studios.
No. At the next live podcast.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. What am I thinking? Yeah. I was playing too small. Sorry,
at the London
Chris.
Podcast Festival, Chris will do the full Monty.
He'll go big.
Can I leave?
And then you'll go home.
You can't leave your ass on.
I'm not sure I'm going big.
Go big or go home.
Yeah.
Can I choose?
Go home afterwards, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can I leave my hat on?
No.
Oh, damn it. No, okay, here's what's going to happen.
Hot stuff.
Here's what I'll do. If I can somehow prove the existence of the Simon Beaufoy commercial, you guys have to pay for me to go to America to recreate it by the pool of a top Los Angeles hotel.
As long as we can put it on Simon Beaufoy's credit card, that's no problem at all.
My counter offer would be that we buy you a ticket to Sheffield. You go to a local swimming pool there and you do it there.
I'm totally up for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, as long as it's next April when the World Snooker Championship is on. Because yeah. I haven't actually booked my train ticket yet.
We're up for that.
All right. Okay. Good. Full Monty. Right. On that note, that is it for this Full Monty podcast in association with Disney Plus. All episodes are available to watch right now on Disney Plus. And all that remains now is for me to say thank you to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning, Kay Ribeiro.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. James Dyer.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye for me as well. I'm off to furiously Google Simon Beaufoy commercial. Any combination of Barclay Card, anything at all. I want to go to Sheffield. I am going to go to Sheffield. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. You can leave your hat on.
Hey everybody, it's Chris here, just jumping in real quick to let you know that I found no evidence of Simon Beaufoy having done an advert when I searched all the usual search engine suspects. I found no evidence of Simon Beaufoy having done an advert at all until I turned to Twitter. And I asked people, did they remember an advert where Simon Beaufoy was by a swimming pool? And Twitter responded, not only overwhelmingly in the affirmative, but they also responded with a link to it on YouTube as part of a series of adverts that were captured during recording of an episode of Inspector Morse from the year 2000, would you believe? And there, lo and behold, is Simon Beaufoy walking through LAX airport in the back of a cab, having dinner alone at Spago's, the idea being that he can walk through LA unannounced and no one will take any notice of him until he sits down and writes on his laptop by a pool, taking off his clothes and stripping down to his underpants to the tune of You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate. And the advert was not for a credit card, I will grant you that. It was for a company called Syntegra. Still not entirely sure what they do, but they have justified me. They have vindicated me and they've made me realize I was not insane and I was not making it up. So take that, James Dyer. Take that, Kay Ribeiro. And take that, Robert Carlyle. Shame on you all for doubting me. Right. On that note, I'm off to look up train times for Sheffield. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. This time, it is goodbye.